I'm gonna give a sermony type sermon, but if that's not your thing today. But if a sermony thing's not your thing today, my invitation is to enter imaginatively into the encounter between Mary and Elizabeth that we heard read. Let these women's pregnant words and pregnant bodies speak to you wherever you are today. And what leaps in you as you meet with them? Or you can listen to me talking, that's fine too. So we have this encounter in our scriptures between Elizabeth and Mary, and it brings together the miraculous conception narratives of John the Baptist and Jesus to hold them together as part of the same story. Now, we think it's probably important that they did that because there were probably two sets of disciples, one following John the Baptist and one following Jesus, and that in the early church this was a potential cause of tension. And so the writers of the Gospels needed to say very clearly, John is on the same team as Jesus. John was not the Messiah, he was pointing to the Messiah, and that was Jesus. Not that some people, I think, were also saying John was pointing to the Messiah and the Messiah is still coming, because it wasn't Jesus, see, he died. So this narrative is a very strong way of drawing the story of John into the story of Jesus and saying this is the story we hold together as one story. It's quite possible that they were not actually related, but that they were. The story of Luke makes them relatives because it's a narrative device to show the closeness and the importance of the two stories being held together. There's a very deliberate contrasting between the old and the new. Elizabeth is old. She's old both in years, but she's also, through being married to a temple priest, she's linked to the old system, the temple system, the old order. John is the last prophet. He's the end of an old thing, a way of being. And then you have Mary, who is the young woman, the very, very young woman. And she embodies, literally and metaphorically, embodies the new order. Jesus is the firstborn of the new kingdom. So here in this account, we have the ending of the old and the starting of the new brought together into one place. And the Magnificat draws, it draws very heavily on imagery out of Hebrew scriptures to illustrate what's ahead. It's bringing the old in to serve the new. So it's not new, really. It's the fulfillment of the revolution that's been long predicted and long hoped for. It alludes to Abraham. It alludes to Hannah and Samuel. It alludes to the Exodus and the Babylonian exile. It uses words in a very similar manner to the prophets of the exile, people like Isaiah. It uses the language that was used in the ancient stories of Hebrew culture to stir hope, to bring that hope into the present for the listeners. The author of the song describes herself as the slave girl, and Israel as the slave boy, at the top and the bottom of the song section are these matching words, which is clearly intended to show that her experiences are to be seen as a manifestation of the salvation history of God. She is the slave girl, Israel is the slave boy. This is the story of God's encounter, God's engagement with the servant people. So did Mary actually write this? Nearly every commentator I read said, absolutely not. Not even possible. There was nearly unanimous agreement that she certainly didn't write it or say it in the context of when she was first pregnant, except for one author who suggested that because she had 4 days to walk from Nazareth to the hill country in Judah, that she spent her time walking, meditating on the story of Hannah, and how her pregnancy was similar to Hannah's miraculous pregnancy with Samuel. And so she gathered together the fragments of what she remembered from Hannah's song to put together something that she was going to say when she got to Elizabeth. I think it's a long bow, but I like the idea. Most commentators think she had nothing to do with it at all. That it's a hymn out of the early Christian community, probably a Hebrew-speaking community with a Jewish culture, early faithful Christians, and that Luke has put this hymn into Mary's mouth to be the opening manifesto of the narrative of who Jesus is. But couldn't Mary have contributed to the early Christian community? I agree it's unlikely she got to Elizabeth and burst out with this, but Luke over and over says that Mary pondered these things that happened to her. She pondered them. She held them deeply and sat with them. And I would like to believe that after the resurrection in the early Christian community, where in Acts it says Mary is there in the early Christian community, that out of her memories and experiences and reflections, she put words to what the whole thing meant in a way that became part of Christian worship. And I have to ask, is the aversion of biblical commentators to allowing this to be Mary's real words because of genuine historical problems with that theory? Or is it a patriarchal mental block to the idea that a woman could write this astonishing text? Or is it perhaps even that we fear that maybe Mary taught Jesus the kingdom rather than the other way around? Perhaps she sang this over his bedside all his childhood until it became part of him and he grew up to preach it. Whether she wrote it or not, the author of Luke clearly had no problems at all attributing it to her. He was confident a woman could have written this, and he wanted it heard in Mary's voice. Songs are not incidental to our story. They're not illustrative tack-ons. From the beginning, they were so integral that they were put into the biblical narrative as expressions of profound truth. And so here it is in our sacred text, the Magnificat. Don't be fooled by this being wrapped up in choral settings and candles and Christmas oratorios. Don't be fooled by Sweet Mary with her blue headcloth in the stained glass. Don't be fooled by the Christmas tinsel and the baubles and the cute chubby baby. This is a song. It's a manifesto. It is a revolutionary constitution. It begins, in Latin, it begins Magnificat, which is why we call it the Magnificat. Magnificat means my soul magnifies. My whole being proclaims the greatness of the Lord, and my spirit rejoices in God my Saviour. This whole being response is very relevant for a song coming from a pregnant body, because it's a very physical response to a very physical blessing. So far, we can all get comfortable. We like this. Great God, Saviour, hooray. Pour me some schnapps. This is good Christmas stuff. But, what comes next? For God has looked on the lowliness of God's slave girl. We are not at the Christmas tree here. We are trekking cross-country with a peasant servant girl, a lowly worker class. This is distinctly from downstairs. Young, female, poor, from a town no one cares about, a rural backwater in an occupied country, possibly as a pregnant teenager without a husband, an outcast even in Nazareth. We lose the impact of this because we've heard it so many times, but she was a nobody. And this is not nothing like where I'm going to be spending my Christmas. But this is where God is looking. God has looked on the lowliness of God's slave girl. When God looks, it is not mere observation. It is noticing. It is loving attention. It is a gaze that draws one into the loving embrace. It is a gaze that enacts change. Just for a moment, or for the rest of the service if you want to, allow yourself to be noticed by God. Experience God's loving attention to you this morning. Mary rejoices in the greatness of God and immediately makes the connection between her personal blessing and the wider story. God has noticed her, an absolute nobody, and God is noticing all the nobodies and calling them somebodies. God's grace is for all because God's grace is for each. One plus one plus one plus one. All the active verbs in this passage show God's actions towards the weak and the poor. And Mary is adamant that God notices, cares, feeds, helps, elevates and loves the lowly, the starving and the powerless. She knows this because she has experienced it herself. And she proclaims it because she trusts it to be true as a general rule. She is herself a parable. She is in herself illustrating the way that the shalom of God works. And then her words in her song spell that out. God comes into the nothing, into the nobody, and makes a something and transforms everything. The core parts of the Magnificat say, God has routed the arrogant of heart. God has pulled down the powerful from their thrones and raised high the lowly. God has filled the starving with good things and sent the rich away empty. God's action is not a spiritual thing, or not only. It is economic, it is social, it is political, it is personal. François Bovon puts it, God places God's power in the service of God's compassion. But compassion for the humble and weak comes into conflict with the mighty of the world. So in consequence of God focusing God's attention so firmly on the weak, those who are not on the side of the weak will not fare so well. In upholding the powerless, the ones who have power over them will lose that power. They'll be removed from their thrones, whatever in each culture is the symbol of magnitude, of power and might, the throne. In bringing the humble into the light, God will turn the light away from the proud who've worked so very hard to have it shining on them. To feed the starving, the storehouses of the rich will be emptied. And those who are accustomed to eating whatever they want will find themselves hungry. These are hard, hard words to listen to. You can sing them in Latin in a choir all you like. They are hard words. In Hebrew, the poem repeats the idea of God as the potent one. In Greek and English, that comes out as powerful, and it loses the sense of fertility and generation of life that potency has in it, which is very relevant for a pregnant girl to be speaking about the blessing of God as the blessing of the potent one. The other gods of the region were fertility gods. And the evidence of their power, supposedly, was in the growing of the crops, the coming of the rain, was in the birth of babies. Mary's song speaks of a God of fertility and potency, but the evidence is not the crops and the rain. The evidence is in the child that she's growing. But it's also in the life being grown in the poor and the outcast. It is in justice being generated in the soil of oppression. This is where the potency of God is. At verse 51 in the middle, it says, by the power of God's arm, the proud have been deposed. The Hebrew word for arm is a homonym for seed or sperm, which means it's spelt different but said the same. So if you write it down, you don't necessarily see it, but if you say it out loud, there's a clear euphemism that's implying by God's seed, the proud have been scattered. The word that we translate as compassion or mercy in Greek links to the steadfast covenant love of God, the love out of the ache and rejection, the love that never gives up, especially that never gives up on God's people when they are oppressed. In Hebrew, the word is linked to the word for womb. So compassion is to do with the womb, rachmim. It is the womb love of God, the bleeding out of God's concerns for the ones birthed by God, nurtured by God, known as the fruits of God's body. Now, actually, we only have Greek versions of this text, so maybe it was written in Greek. But as the words for a pregnant woman speaking of God's concern for suffering people, I think what's there in the Hebrew, the strong allusions to the potency, the fertility and the womb love, I think that was a more likely original form for what we've got here. God's power is in the generation of justice, the nurturing into life of all those who are oppressed. God's love is the never-failing ache of a mother for the children she has birthed. I'm going to say that again because that's probably the most important bit. God's power is the generation of justice, the nurturing into life of all those who are oppressed. God's love is the never-failing ache of a mother for the child she has birthed. Mary is acclaimed for her great yes to God earlier in Luke 1. And we are encouraged to likewise say yes to God. But what is it we say yes to? For Mary, this was not an intellectual assent, but a whole of life embodiment of God's desire for her. It was not just yes to a particular supernatural experience of conception in her own life. It was yes to the way of God, the transformation of the social order so that the weak are the chosen ones and the privileged lose their power. What Mary said yes to was the Magnificat, the manifesto for a new way of life, the complete turning upside down of the usual order of things. As Protestants, we're not often that comfortable with imitating Mary, but she's an incredible character. She's presented here as the first to proclaim the revolution of God that is coming to fruition in Jesus. So as Protestants, do we shy away from imitating Mary because we're uneasy with cultures of Marian piety? Or do we shy away because it is too hard to say yes to the God she said yes to? What does it mean for me to say yes to a God who pulls down the powerful and lifts up the weak? Because I am more powerful than weak. What does it mean to say yes to a God who feeds the hungry and leaves the rich empty? Because I am more rich than hungry. What does it mean to say yes to a God who loves those who fear God but leaves in self-deception those who are full of themselves and their ideas and their own power? Because I am more confident in my own abilities than dependent on God. Mary was confident in God's potency, not in her own abilities. The song in her name is all written as if it had already happened. Rachel Held Evans in a blog this week wrote, "The Magnificat is the stubborn, unsentimental hope of a woman so convinced that the baby inside her would change everything, that she proclaimed in present tense that the great reversal had already arrived." I like that idea of the stubborn, unsentimental hope that it had already arrived. Mary describes a reality where there are two ways of being: to be lowly and beloved of God, or to be God with all the power, looking with love on the lowly. And then a third category seems to appear, those who have their own power and are using their power to oppress others. But the Magnificat says this third category is an illusion. It doesn't exist. The only power is God's power. Only God has true potency. And the rest are lowly and just don't know it yet. Which is both a threat and a comfort, because the lowly are the beloved of God. So if we rich people are lowly and we just don't know it yet, what we don't know is how deeply we are in the gaze of God in our nothingness. And yet it is self-evident that the powerful remain powerful, the hungry remain hungry, the privileged remain rich. So was this author, the author of this song, just deluded? Or can we honestly say that the conception of Jesus was the fulfillment of the promises that Jesus later preached and that Jesus' followers have for 2,000 years been working and hoping towards embodying? And here is where I think it matters that this is a song, because the revolutions of our time are accompanied by songs. The protest anthems of the 60s held the hopes and truths of those movements and carried them into our day. So the Magnificat is like a Bob Dylan or a Woody Guthrie tune. It's like the songs we sing at protest marches. It's like We Will Overcome or Freedom Is Coming. Or this week, We Are One But We Are Many. It's an anthem. And an anthem doesn't sing, "We hope this might happen one day because it really should and it would be the best option." An anthem proclaims, "This is the reality," and expects those listening and those singing will change in response until the anthem becomes true. Protest songs don't provide information, they bring about change. Protest songs do not provide us with information. They bring about change. And that is what the Magnificat is for. So can I let this song change me? Can I sing it until my priorities align with the upside-down kingdom, putting the needs of the poor before my own, voting for the benefit of the weak rather than myself? Serving the hungry rather than my own rich belly. Protest songs are dangerous because the marginalised are not oppressed by coincidence. My privilege contributes to other people's poverty. And the protest songs of our day and of this day name that. The Magnificat, in the words of Luther, comforts the poor but terrifies the rich. If I took this seriously, I would find myself well outside my comfort zone. So will I say yes to the God of the Magnificat? Will you? Will I sing the protest song of the Kingdom Revolution? Will I live into it until it becomes embodied in me, as it was quite literally inside the body of Mary? It is terrifying. But also, it is embedded in the womb love of God, who yearns for me, for you, for each person of our world, with the ache of a mother who cannot, who will not, forget the children grown inside her very being. I'm going to invite us to say it together as our own prayer, if I can make it work. Maybe we could stand, because we stand to sing. If you would like to, maybe like to is not the right word. If you feel you are able today to have a go at meaning this, then We'll say it together.
My whole being proclaims the greatness of the Lord, and my spirit exalts in God my Saviour, because God has regarded God's servant in the lowest place. Behold, all future generations will see my happiness. For the Potent One has done me great things. Holy is the name of God. God's faithful womb love extends from generation to generation to all who fear God. God has shown the strength of God's arm and routed the arrogant of heart. God has pulled down the powerful from their places of power and raised high the lowly. God has filled the starving with good things and sent the rich away empty. God has come to help God's servant Israel, remembering with compassion, according to the promise God made to our ancestors, to have mercy to Abraham and his descendants forever.
Amen. Yeah, we'll just grab the microphone and...
When we were in Nazareth, there was a young woman hiding in the Nazareth hospital, the Christian hospital there where we were working, because she was unmarried and pregnant. And she was terrified of what her family were going to do to her. And eventually the staff at the hospital smuggled her out of the country to save her life. That really hit me, because it made me realise that Mary was an unmarried young woman in a similar culture. If she'd been promised in marriage, she'd have been taken out to the city gates and her husband would have been entitled to stone her to death. And yet Mary seemed to understand what God had asked of her, to the extent that that sort of danger that she was in was secondary to her recognition of what God was asking of her and what it meant. And that just blew me away. Her incredible courage and her insight as to what it meant was amazing.
It could also be why she fled to Elizabeth's house for a while, until things died down and she could go home safely.
I'm presuming that we can assume that Jesus didn't come to just create another class of goodies and baddies, so that God, in lifting up those who are poor and oppressed, was not creating a new upper class that he would then subsequently disregard and go and look for the new lower class, you know? And I'd like to hear a bit more about that, because I think it's very simplistic to go, oh, they're the bad people, all those rich people are bad people, we're going to have them put down and we're going to lift up the poor people, and thus just create the same crap that we deal with.
I think one of the amazing things about Mary is that she's the embodiment of having been lifted up. She hasn't stopped being poor, she's still fleeing for her life, and yet she recognises a change in state in herself, that she has been looked on favourably by God and her value as a person is honoured and affirmed and esteemed. And my sense of lifting up the lowly and bringing down the proud is not about crushing the proud, but about bringing everyone into a position where we are able to see our own value and be esteemed as the God-created people we are, not because we're very rich or because we're very poor. Thanks.
My favourite protest song at the moment, and it's got lots of swearing in it, and it's by three black rappers, so be aware. But it's by Nerd, and it starts off, because it's rap, it starts off with a spoken bit that says, "The truth will set you free, but it will piss you off first." And I think my pissed offedness today is about how deeply political this stuff is. Like, I've never heard the Magnificat. Like, in Baptist churches, it's just not talked about. And I became a Christian in a Baptist church. And so, yeah, I'm pissed off.
We have a friend who's really struggling to become pregnant and a lot of health issues. And how do you think this song speaks to somebody who's struggling at that level?
In those specifically around fertility, I have no idea. I have no idea. My hope would be that as a song of liberation, that it can speak to whoever is feeling oppressed, whether it's by their own body or an external thing. But I recognise that that has never been my issue, and I don't know how this would sound from that place. Others here I know would.